Hello, everybody, and welcome to our Future in Space Hangout, where every 2 weeks we take an in-depth look at the future of human spaceflight, the technologies of space, and the engineering challenges that face humanity's future in space exploration and discovery. I want to welcome everybody watching live, as well as those of you who are watching this hangout after the live event is over. My name is Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space, and today we are continuing a series that was started by my co-host, Hardy Thronson, where we check in with the four main contenders for the next big space-based astronomical observatory. Now, I'm going to just give you a brief rundown of what they are, the four big concepts that are being considered by NASA right now. The first one, LUVOIR, which stands for the Large UV Optical IR Surveyor, which will tell the story of life by searching for signs of life on exoplanets and exploring the cosmic origins of life. It will have a huge wavelength range from the far ultraviolet to the near infrared, and its primary mirror will be up to 6 times larger than Hubble's. The next one is HABEX, which is the Habitable Exoplanet Explorer, which will search for signatures of habitability, including water, oxygen, or ozone, and it will also study the early universe and the life cycle of massive stars. Like LUVOIR, HABEX will be sensitive to ultraviolet, optical, and near-infrared wavelengths. There's also LINX, which I guess is not an acronym for anything, but it is the successor to the Chandra X-ray Telescope, currently up in space, and will look at the universe in X-rays. LINX will have a 2 orders of magnitude jump in sensitivity over Chandra, as well as the European Space Agency's Advanced Telescope for High Energy Astrophysics, which they're calling Athena. And that's due to launch in 2028. It will detect X-rays from black holes lighting up the first galaxies and from young stars and their planetary systems. But our hangout today will focus on the Origins Space Telescope, or OST. And our guests today have been working on the mission concept of a new space telescope that will probe the early universe, trace the path of water through star and planet formation, and search for signs of life in the atmospheres of exoplanets. It's considered a follow-on to the Spitzer Space Telescope, which has given us some amazing views of the universe, as well as the Herschel Space Observatory. OST will offer 10,000 times more sensitivity than any preceding far infrared telescope. So our plan here is to visit these main mission concept teams each year until one of them is selected to see how things are progressing. So let me turn this over to my co-host and I'll let him tell you more about the selection process and when we might expect to hear about a winner. So Hardy Thronson from the NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Hardy?
Yep, thanks very much. And this is a particularly exciting mission for me. Although it's been many years since I was a practicing astrophysicist, when I was mainly observed the wavelengths we'll be hearing about today and some of the science goals that we'll hear about today, although they've progressed enormously since I undertook my last serious research program. But the research area, the scientific areas that we'll be talking about today have been very close to my heart, so this should be very exciting. And in fact, actually, I'm not going to put into context these four missions, the political context, the selection context. I'm going to pass it off to one of the two senior scientists that we have here. But before I do, we want to make sure that we thank the two AASs that make this possible, the American Astronomical Society and the American Astronautical Society. They don't endorse the content and opinions, but they do endorse this activity. So
good clarification.
So so we have two colleagues I've known for many years. Dave Lester. Sorry.
Nope.
No, that's
Dan Lester.
David Lazowitz. My apologies.
No Dan, problem.
Yes, Dan Lester. Actually, there's no Dave Lester. There probably is. No, Lester is the guy I have presentations with on Wednesday afternoons. David Lazowitz, who's my colleague down the hall in my building at Goddard Space Flight Center. And we have Margaret Meisner from a distinguished scientist at the Space Telescope Science Institute, but she is currently on sabbatical here at the Goddard Space Flight Center. So with that meandering introduction, I'd like to ask, let's begin by asking Margaret to put into context, well, to describe the process from where we are now, where NASA is, as Tony said, NASA is has been funding design activities for major candidate missions for, you know, a couple of decades or decade and a half from now. So, Margaret, where are you all going from here? What's the schedule? What are you all expected to deliver to NASA headquarters and then to the national academies?
All right. Thank you, Tony and Harley, for inviting us to talk about our favorite project, which is Origin Space Telescope Study. We are in the throngs of putting together what we call the final report. And it's we have two concepts we'll be presenting. Concept two, we're finishing up the engineering over the next month. And these are engineering at a level that you can kind of scope out the mission, what they call concept maturity level three or four. These concepts, along with the very strong science case we have, will be delivered to headquarters. There'll be a process where they're going to go through a costing exercise that's independent from us, and the final report will be delivered to the National Academy basically summer 2019. So summer 2019, we can kind of take a breath and they're like, finally take a vacation or something. But we are, you know, working flat out, I think, as a sprint until then.
Okay, great. So thanks, guys. And I want to remind everybody that we are live. So please use this opportunity to speak directly with our guests through our live chat on YouTube, which if you're watching on YouTube, you can't miss it. And we also have a Discord server for those gamers out there. And the link to that is in our description box. And I'll be reading from both of those places as the Hangout progresses. So please take advantage of getting direct access to experts here working on the future of space astronomy. Now, as Harley mentioned, we're supported and endorsed, but the content necessarily isn't endorsed by the American Astronautical Society, as well as the American Astronomical Society. And also, I just want to mention Deep Astronomy Patreon patrons whose financial support also help bring these Hangouts to you. So please, I want to thank everybody for their support on all of these fronts. Okay, so let's see. Margaret, let's start, I guess, with, you mentioned that by summer 2019, all of these you at least have to have your proposal and ready and done. Is that true for all of the projects, or is it different?
Yeah, no, we're all kept to the same schedule. So all of them will be collated and submitted en masse to the decadal. And in the meantime, we're also, of course, we continue our community outreach, and it's a very public process. We have now weekly telecons that people can listen in on. And we
just anybody?
It's on the public site. Yeah, anybody.
Wow. So these are they just meetings where you talk? I didn't know this. I may start going. You can just call in and listen?
Yes, you can call. If you go to our NASA Goddard site, it gives you the telecon connection or the WebEx connection, and we discuss. There's a lot of nitty-gritty detail that we discuss, like, you know, what about this graph? But it's all kept as public as possible.
Seems,
we are always interested in, of course, getting public input on what we're doing.
That seems unusual. Is this in an effort to be super transparent about the missions themselves?
Oh, yeah. We were asked by headquarters to be as connected to the community as possible, and we took that seriously, starting our first summer with large community outreaches to get their ideas of what they thought was important to study.
Let me add something here. Margaret is exactly right. It's very impressive. All four of these missions, and then of course other NASA activities, are available on their website. It is a very I myself check on these websites every other week or so. Very accessible, very informative. Of course, these missions are being led by serious professionals, examples of the two folks we have here, but there are aspects or elements of all of their websites that are entirely readable by the literate public.
Oh, yeah.
It's fascinating stuff, and as almost everybody in our audience are taxpayers, it's well worth their time to see what their taxes might go for in the next several years as one or maybe more of these missions are funded and flown.
Okay, I want to just ask one more question on this and we'll move on to the topic at hand, because this is interesting. Was this something that the Science Mission Directorate does only, or is it a NASA-wide sort of initiative now to try and be more transparent with everything it does?
Oh, I can't speak for anything beyond science. I can't even actually speak for the science. I'm just telling you what
they
want.
Told you. Okay, sure.
They told you, they said these have to be pub. And we would have done that anyhow. It's a very community driven, most of the members guiding the study are from outside of NASA.
Okay, well, there you go, folks. So definitely, if you want to learn, I mean, you really want to get access and behind the scenes looks at how these projects and missions are handled, you might want to go and check that out. You say there's information on the OST website. So
Type in Origin Space Telescope on Google, and we'll have two websites, one at IPAC Caltech, one at Goddard. They both have useful information.
Okay, well, let's get into OST itself. Adam Synergy, I see your question and I agree. I want to ask it, but first I want to give a little bit of background, a little summary. And I think maybe David, you could do that for us. Give us some, I gave a couple of one-liners on what OST is, but maybe you can give us a summary on the project science goals.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, Tony. There are three main goals that we've been tracking, and there are many, many other things that we can do with this telescope. The three that motivate things and actually establish requirements for the engineering design are the question, are we alone? And I won't go into details. Margaret's going to cover that topic. But it, as you can probably surmise, it has something to do with looking for life elsewhere in the universe.
Would you like me to put up that graphic or not?
You can go ahead and talk about that. We can freeform this.
All right, I have it up if you want.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead then, Margaret? Should I continue with just the three highlights?
And why don't you do the three highlights and then I'll talk about.
Okay. So the graphic that you're seeing is the first of the three science themes for the mission. The second one is when planets form, how do they form and how do some of them become habitable? How do they acquire the conditions that would enable life to be sustained? And then the third goal is looking far into the deep universe, far back in time, and asking how galaxies work. How does the whole universe work? But in particular, how do galaxies work? So you might recognize some of these themes as themes that are covered by other missions, but every mission is designed to provide unique information, and they work together really to answer these questions. But these are the three main questions that OST will tackle and that it's designed to do.
Okay.
So now maybe good back to you, Margaret.
Yeah. So let's just talk a little bit more about are we alone? So as Tony mentioned, there are three of these studies that are looking at this question, are we alone? And we're doing it in a different way than Havex and LUVOIR is. We're doing it by, if you look in this picture, you'll see on the top right, kind of a reddish star. That's a picture of an M dwarf, which is one of the most numerous stars in the galaxy. And by far, it's like over 75% of the stars near the Earth are M stars. And you can see some black circles going in front, and that actually connotes how we're going to observe them. We're going to observe them through the transit method, which is a very precise way to learn a lot about these things. You can learn about their size, their mass, their densities, through just transit measurements, even before OST flies. And what OST will be doing is selecting some of these candidates that will be studied by TESS and JWST and stuff, and following up to determine, do they have the spectrum that we're showing here in front of this imagined habitable planet circling the M dwarf star. And this spectral range that Origin Space Telescope offers is rich in molecular spectroscopy, and it's ideal for understanding the composition of the planetary atmosphere and hence life. So here's a spectrum from 5 to 20 microns, and the key molecules to look for are methane, which is the far left one, ozone, which is 3 oxygens, carbon dioxide, CO2, and water, H2O. And according to experts who study atmospheric chemistry, the only way you can get methane and ozone, which is a tracer of oxygen, in a planetary atmosphere is to have life in the chemical loop. That is, you need something that is life that is going to translate all the atmospheric things from sort of oxygen into a methane. things like carbon dioxide and water are necessary to support life as we know it. They're called bioindicators. They're indication that life could form. But the ozone and the methane together, the only way we know how to get that is with life. And so if we, and the goal is to basically
you need both.
And the nice thing about the spectral range is you get both in one spectrum. And it's a very difficult measurement to make. We think it's within our grasp if we work harder on improving detectors. But yes, you need both.
And this this wavelength range, 5 to 20 microns, this is not visible. It's not possible from the ground, is it?
Most of it is not. I mean, there's little bits and pieces, but certainly at the sensitivity and the stability you need, because, basically they need 5 parts per million stability in the measurement, which is a challenge, but we think we can do it with some investment in detectors.
Now one of the things,
you only get that stability in space. Space is incredibly stable compared to being on Earth.
And is this going to go to the L2 point?
Yes.
Okay. Now, one of the things that JWST promises when it launches is a similar capability of looking at the light from a star as it goes through the any atmosphere that might be present in a transiting exoplanet. Is Origins going to be augmenting that with a wider wavelength range? Because I don't think JWST goes down that far, does it?
It does. It does overlap, but JWST spectrographs were not designed with the same stability in mind. First of all, they split the interesting spectral range with 2 instruments. We would do 1 instrument, and then you need to design the spectrometer to be immune to pointing or jitter instabilities, and then also the detectors have to be amazingly stable. And at the time JWST was designed, transiting exoplanets was just starting as a field. And of course, it's skyrocketed since then. But the initial design of the spectrometers were never meant to meet these very difficult 5 parts per million stability requirements. And so Origins is actually building a very, very specialized ultra-stable spectrometer to do this science case. Now, other astronomers will probably think of other uses for it, but it will be designed to hit this science goal.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. And this is something that it looks like the better, if you can design the instrument with this science case in mind, as you point out, where it was kind of done after JWST was sort of designed, it makes for a better data set. Did you want to say anything more about the Are We Alone part, or do you want to go on to forming habitable?
Well, I'll just say that, our goal with the observing strategy is to have 1 to 10 detections of basically habitability around other.
I don't understand what that means. 1 to 10.
Well, okay. 1 to 10 exoplanets. So they, basically they're going to be picking the best candidates, but the goal is to identify at least 1 to 5 exoplanets with the signature of methane and ozone. That is, we basically detect that there's life on another world.
And are you going to get your candidates to look at with Origins from some other wide field telescope?
Oh, yes.
Tests?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Honestly. Well, there's a number of people going after these candidates, but we think we'll have candidates that will be, of course, looked at with JWST. But this project, this ability to detect biosignatures, is beyond JWST capabilities.
Okay. And let me go ahead and get Larry Keese's question in, because it's relevant to what you're directly talking about right now. He's asking you, could you talk more about the stability requirements? That's my nook. So what do you mean when you talk about stability?
Right. So basically, imagine these planets orbiting in front of the star. Basically, we want everything to be stable in the instrument into 5 parts per million as the planet moves in front and then behind. So in the order of an hour, when it's looking at a star, that if they see a change, that change is due to the planet and not the instrument. So when we mean the instrument has to be stable, meaning that its ability to detect the flux, it doesn't vary, like, oh, it's, you know, you know, 1% higher, low, 1% lower. It's always reading the same measurement. So like, I don't know, let's say it, I'm trying to think of an equivalent of measuring, like measuring temperature. Let's say you're measuring the temperature of something. You want that any temperature change to be measured, like if you're cooking something, that if you see a temperature change, that that is due to something physically happening, not due to the thermometer itself. The thermometer has to be able to reflect and be stable with that measurement.
And
the- so Margaret, that was that your point a few minutes ago when you said five parts in a million?
Yes.
Between, the noise level, every instrument has got noise of various kinds. There's not a perfect instrument. And your team's calculation of the noise requirement, the noise limit to the instrument, is you've got to be able to measure something better than five parts out of a million.
That's right. And so this is stability. So it's a differential measurement. So you're measuring the flux of the star and you're subtracting that flux, but any variation in that flux has to be, the instrument has to be stable to five parts per million, because the signal itself is only, you know, a factor of three times that, you know, it's 15 parts per million. So you have to measure it to five parts per million to get a significant detection of it.
Well, while we're maybe
this might help as well. So typically, what would be a typical decrease in brightness, broadband, that is a wide range in wavelengths, of an Earth-like star passing in front of a typical M dwarf? How much is the light reduced by the eclipse, if you will, of a planet like the Earth passing in front of an M dwarf star?
That's a good question. I don't know it off the top of my head. I know it's actually, it's fairly deep compared to what it would be in front of a solar-like star, just because the contrast between the planet is bigger compared to the star.
Say a small fraction of a percent.
Yeah,
I'm even thinking it's pretty less than that. It's tiny. I'm going to say maybe 10 to the minus 4.
Yeah, so, and then because you all are looking for spectral features, which can be smaller still, that's why you need this incredible instrument stability.
Yes.
Okay, let me just, while we're on this topic, ask you what a typical measurement would look like then. What would be an exposure time that would, as the planet is transiting the star surface, what are your planned exposure times going to be for these spectra?
We're going to be reading them out as they go. So the exposure time might be on the order of seconds or minutes, depending on how bright the star is. They'll be continuously recorded, sent down for analysis, and it'll be spectral. So it won't be broadband, as we just discussed. It'll be basically a spectrum looking, you know, like the spectrum you see in this cartoon drawing of what we're trying to get. It will be a spectrum of all the wavelengths at once, all simultaneously.
So
kind of low resolution, in the sense that it'll be what they, you know, it won't be the highest spectral resolution, but high enough that we can separate the features.
So through the 5 to 20 micron range, the light from the star will be split up into a spectrum.
Yes.
And then that light, that spectra will be recorded continuously. The shutter will just be open. Light will be coming in, falling in on the spectrograph. Then the spectra are recorded continuously as the planet goes across the face of the sun, disk of the sun, star, I should say. And then those readings are then, I guess, do you co-add them down on the ground to make a stronger signal, or do you not need to do that? It's not an image.
No. In fact, they talk about how many transits do you need, you know, one transit. And they said their tiered surveys is, you know, they'll first look at, you know, let's say 10 candidates, good candidates that'll be vetted from prior observations, and they'll do one transit. And with that, they'll be able to see if there's water and ozone.
Okay. All right.
Or water and carbon dioxide. And then from that, they'll go all the way up to like 65, 70 transits. And each transit gives you a signal, and they co-add all of that.
And co-add means we're just going to take previous observations and add them to the
keep adding it together to improve the signal to noise all with 5 parts per million, and to get down to see basically the methane.
Okay. We are blazing through this hangout, and I want to make sure we get to the other science cases. So let's talk about the next one. That's the life detection part, the biosignature part of what Origins is planning to do.
Right.
But it's also going to be looking at habitable planets and how they form. Who wants to talk about this? I've got that graphic up, by the way.
That one is for me to do.
Okay.
So let's see. This graphic, it's got words on it that are more complex than probably most of your audience really cares to digest. But let me just summarize by saying, okay, well, I'd be happy to entertain detailed questions, and maybe I'll even get it right. So what you're looking at here is the edge on disk of a forming planetary system. So this is a slice through that disk. Used to be thought that the disks were flatter, that they might be like a pancake or something, but in fact, they actually have a flare to them. So you can see the wedge opening. The star is off on the left here. And so you're only seeing one side of the disk, but if you actually expanded the view, you would have the other side of the disk to the left. So one very important feature that you see here is the dashed line labeled snow line, and the snow line delineates the place where water is either too warm on the outside of the disk, so that it's either vaporized or liquid, or inside the disk where dust shields the starlight and it gets quite cold, and it's cold enough for water to be frozen. And when it's frozen, it freezes out on the surfaces of dust grains and things that we would call planetesimals, which are dust grains coagulating together to become planets. That planet formation process, there are good theories and minimal observations. So we really want to understand how planets form and when they form. How does water wind up on the surface of a planet like ours that is at the right distance, you could say the Goldilocks distance, so that the planet itself can have a liquid ocean? So again, there are theories and some reasons to believe that comets deposited the water that makes the Earth's oceans. We can trace that through the signature of the ratio of deuterium to hydrogen, deuterium being a heavier isotope of hydrogen, and that ratio is different in different comets, and in some of them it's the same as in the Earth's oceans, and that's a clue to the possibility that our oceans came from comets early in the formation of the solar system. But largely speaking, this theory really needs to be borne out by future observations, and so a very important thing to understand is how is the material distributed in a system like this, a disk that's forming planets, and during that process, how does water wind up on the surface of a planet, making it habitable as we understand habitability, which does for at least all of our living critters depend on water.
Well, this is I'm going to go ahead and ask Andrew Planet's question, since it's also relevant to this exact slide. He's asking, is it true that water, a known life-dependent solvent, is part and parcel byproduct of stellar evolution? I mean, in this graph here, this water was in the, was it a debris disk, or I don't know what you call.
I would call this a protoplanetary disk.
Protoplanetary disk, thank you. It was just already there, right?
Yes, that's a really excellent question. So we have measured water in the general interstellar medium. That's the gas and dust clouds between stars. If you look at the Milky Way in a nice dark sky, you can see dark patches, and those are gas and dust clouds. And inside those clouds, it's very cold and the water is frozen. But in the warmer part of the interstellar medium outside of those clouds, water is in vapor form, gas form, and it has a spectral signature, and that signature has been measured. So we know that water is out there. It's really pretty much all over the place, although it tends to freeze out on dust grain surfaces when they're cold enough. And So it's not too surprising that there is a reservoir of water out there. It's really the question of how does it wind up on a planet's surface that we want to know about.
Okay, great. And this will be done by OST via spectra again? I mean, I don't want to get too much. Is this going to look at spectra of the protoplanetary, or the, protoplanetary disk and see?
Yes. Really, OST in general is very heavily oriented toward spectroscopy, measuring spectral lines.
Okay.
And those, they may be a little bit less sexy for the general public to look at. They just look like graphs, like the one that Margaret showed a moment ago. But in fact, that's where all the information is. So to an astronomer, a spectrum is very rich with information, and that's what OST is largely designed to give us. It does make images too, and I'm sure we'll hear about that along the way.
Yeah, okay. And the final science case, I love this question. How does the universe work? I've got the graphic up. OST will study galaxy and black hole co-evolution.
Yes, right. So one of the cool things about Origin Space Telescope is that it can look at the redshifted universe. So this plot has two axes. On the right, on y-axis, it's the observed wavelengths. And this kind of covers the observed wavelength, starting with basically all the way to
Alma,
which is...
Let me try muting.
Okay.
Which is a ground-based millimeter observatory. And Origin Space Telescope basically gets to observe the universe in between where JWST drops off and ALMA picks up. So it fills a very important probe of galaxy and black hole evolution that is really not accessible in any other way. On the x-axis, we have redshift. And then on the left, we see what we call a spectral energy distribution, which is basically the flux per unit wavelength of a galaxy. So as it starting at the top, at the longest wavelength, as you come up, you see kind of a peak. And that's basically dust emission from the interstellar medium, which is the birthplace of stars. And it's, if you will, the fuel of star and galaxy evolution. And then as you go downwards, you're actually picking up, information on the shorter wavelengths, and then also information on the stars. And there are lots of points or, spikes on this spectral energy distribution, and those spikes are spectral lines. So these are the things like, you'll see hydrogen or you'll see magnesium or iron, and these spectral lines, if you detect them, tell you a lot about the physics of what is actually going on in that galaxy. And we'll be able, with these spectral lines, be able to trace things like the active galactic nuclei. That's this in red on the ground, on the lowest part, on the left. All the things that are red will basically be spectral lines that say, what is the AGN activity in this galaxy? And then in green is what is the feedback. So AGN blow winds provide feedback to the galaxy. Stars, when they're born, they blow around the gas that provides the feedback. And then at top, and perhaps the most numerous of the lines in blue, is what is happening with the star formation. You can probe the rate, how many stars of what type are in the galaxy. So all this spectral information will be gotten in one go with Origin Space Telescope over a huge spectral range over key points, like the peak of galaxy evolution at redshift 2, which is the first dashed line from the left, or the peak epoch of reionization, which is out at redshift longer than 6 redshifts. And so you'll be able to probe all these key parts and learn about, in particular, the gas that's feeding all this activity in a galaxy. So Origin Space Telescope is going to be absolutely key for understanding how do galaxies and black holes co-evolve, what triggers them. I mean, galaxies were very different in the past. And the key difference is in the past, you had more gas compared to stars in all these galaxies. And so Origins will be absolutely provide fundamental breakthroughs in how we understand this whole process. And since we observe the universe basically through galaxies, it's going to really tell us how the universe actually works.
Did you design this graphic, Margaret?
I did not.
There is a lot of information.
There is a lot of information here. It's densely packed, but I think the main thing
it's amazing.
Wants the audience to take away is that Origins is going to fill in this critical gap in how galaxies evolve over this redshift space, because it really fills in a wavelength range we cannot do from the ground.
So yeah, it looks like about if you look at the arrows of JWST versus ALMA, there's that yellowish band across the center that says what Origins will look like, and it looks like it's going to be active from about redshift 4 through on, actually, and be able to see all of these different spectra of these different three events or feedback mechanisms, star formation, AGNs, things like that, all the way through very, very distant wavelengths, something that JWST nor ALMA. Now, ALMA is a ground-based, by the way, folks, sub-millimeter array that is one of the most high-resolution radio telescopes ever commissioned, and it's an amazing unit, and it tells us a lot, but it has limits, and this is filling in the gap there of what that limit is. This is really a really cool graphic, actually. Okay, well, So those are the science cases of what the Origin Space Telescope is hoping to address if it is built. And let me just get to a couple. Raj Luther has some really good questions. I want to get to a couple of them here. He's asking, how accurate will Origins be compared to other space telescopes? I guess comparing the kinds of observations that, you know, JWST will do versus what Origins can do. How much more accurate will it be?
Well, it'll be more accurate in terms of detecting objects and stuff by orders of magnitude. So, you know, prior observatories like Spitzer and Herschel said, oh, we've detected, you know, water in three disks. Well, Origins is going to detect water in thousands of disks very easily. And so in terms of when you think of anything, any scientific study, you need statistics, you need large numbers. So in terms of measuring more things to get better statistics, that is one area of improvement. There'll be also spectral accuracy. So the more you spread the light out, the more accurate you can get wavelengths and also the motion, the kinematics, the dynamics of what's happening with the gas. And that's something that Origins will do more precisely in these galaxies than has been done before. And then just detectors and our ability to calibrate how bright things really are will be better. And so all those things will be a big improvement.
Okay. And one more question from Raj, then I want to get to the spacecraft itself. He's asking, Raj Luthra, how far back in the universe time will Origins see? Now, I'll put this graph back up again, and it was showing that you're going out, well, the redshift 8 is one of the ones, but presumably it can go back even further.
We think that there'll be... And it won't be, I would say we might go back to redshift 10 or 12 on particular cases. At redshift 6, we're going to get all the galaxies.
Yeah.
We will see all the galaxies, full sample, all the way down to very tiny galaxies, and get a very good statistical sample out to at least redshift 6. But there'll be, you know, either really bright objects or very interesting and exotic objects that will go out to redshift 10, 12, possibly beyond, possibly seeing the first galaxies form if we see them, you know, in front of a gravitational lens that helps this out. But I know people will go after those because
they're doing it.
That's what astronomers that's what astronomers do.
Gravitational lensing is our friend,
so,
for sure.
So we think that will be one of those high reward observing programs that we know the TAC will allow time for people to hunt for that.
Okay. TAC is a time allocation committee. And
that's
all right.
It might be helpful to some of the audience to convert. You have to make assumptions about the universe to convert redshifts.
Yes, I do that all the time.
Yes, Tony. Redshift 8, for example, to how long was that after the Big Bang? How short was that actually after the Big Bang?
Oh, you know, I mean, they're hoping for the ones that are really, really far out there and forming galaxies the first time. I think they're hoping they're going to detect things within the first billion years of first, of basically the Big Bang, you know.
Yeah, get okay. Very close to the first galaxies.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, this is a stretch case for Origins, I would say, but astronomers always seem to get there when you give them a facility. But they're hoping to see the formation of the first galaxies.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the spacecraft. I'm looking at the time. Let's talk about the spacecraft a little bit. I have the graphic that you guys sent of the concept of the spacecraft itself. Who wants to talk a little bit about it?
Hi,
Dave. That would be my doing. So first of all, apologies for the thunderstorm in the background. Every now and then that's louder
than
me. Yep, that's what that was. So you see on your screen a picture of what we're calling our second concept for the Origin Space Telescope. We've already completed a study of a first concept, which actually more closely resembles JWST, for those of your audience who recognize what JW looks like. This was quite different. The architecture here looks a lot more like the Spitzer Space Telescope, where the telescope itself is surrounded by a tubular kind of thing to keep it cold. So let me step back before I go into some of these little highlights here and say that when you conduct a study like this, part of it is what we just walked you through, which is the science. The science has to be absolutely compelling, rock solid, very exciting, things that people really, really want to get the answers to. But then there's a whole second ingredient, which is that you want to maximize the bang for the buck. And so that's where the engineering design comes into play, and a lot of back and forth between the science goals and the engineering design work. And so our concept one was a first cut look at how you might implement this mission. And concept two is a second round of iteration on that greatly improves the bang for the buck. One of the ways that it does that is by borrowing an architecture that's been used before. So we call that heritage. And this has heritage that resembles the Spitzer Space Telescope or the Herschel Space Telescope or the Planck Observatory. And in addition, a very important part of this design is that it has very few deployments. In other words, moving parts. It launches just about the way you see it here, and the way you see it here is the way it will appear when it's used. So it's got a couple of layers of sun shades that you can see on the left-hand side there. The telescope is nestled down in the middle, surrounded by that tubular structure. In order to operate over the wavelengths that OST is designed to cover, which is from 5 microns to 610 microns, it gains its tremendous sensitivity through two means. One is that the telescope is extraordinarily cold, about 4 degrees above absolute zero, or 4 degrees Kelvin. And the second thing that we do is to use the best possible detectors that are in development now, but not fully mature yet. But we know we can get there. You're about to hear thunder again,
okay.
I think. Just a forewarning. So anyway, those two things, the cold temperature and the detectors, make for that factor of 10,000 improvement in sensitivity over any past far infrared mission. You do certainly benefit in sensitivity by having a large collecting area to collect the light with the telescope. And this particular implementation of OST has the same collecting area, 25 square meters, as JWST. Now, some of your listening audience probably knows that JWST is a hexagonal primary mirror. This one is round instead. So there are some detailed differences, all sorts of detailed differences, but these are some of the key features of the design. So let me turn it back to you in case there are some questions on this topic.
Okay, I just I want to apologize to people who kept seeing the other graphic blinking in the place. I had accidentally made a playlist and didn't know it. So it kept going back and forth between the two images of how the universe works and this one. I think I finally have it fixed now. So this is going to be the a preliminary design of Origins. And my question has to do with, okay, so I know this is a sensitive subject, but when I was reading an Atlantic article on JWST, and I think it listed that, you know, it was talking about the culture at NASA and some of the optimistic ways in which NASA has been thinking, that they listed, and they didn't list in the article, that there were about 10 technologies that had to be invented in order to meet the science case of JWST, which is one of the reasons why it's over budget and behind schedule. So my question to you is, how many, are there any technologies with OST that are in that case where they have yet to be invented in order for the science to be done with OST?
That's a very fair concern. And the answer is yes. The two principal technologies are the detectors and the cryocoolers that make things, that remove heat from the telescope and make things cold. Now, the nice thing about the cryocoolers is that there's a cryocooler in JWST that's already passed that that test, essentially. So it's already a mature technology.
Okay.
So we have really one area that requires technology maturation, and that's detectors. We have, for the far infrared, we use different kinds of detectors at different wavelength ranges, and they have different kinds of requirements on them. One nice thing about the far infrared detectors is that they're two different competing technologies that are primarily the ones that are in the running, and both of them are developing in parallel. There is NASA investment presently in these detectors, and they are maturing, although not at the pace we would love to see. I mean, if OST is accepted by the decadal survey, then funding will increase for detector technology for this mission. And the pace of development will certainly pick up. But we really, you know, the basic answer to your question is we have one principal area that needs technology work, not 10. And that's the detectors.
Okay. Well, that's a good, okay. So I want to dive into that a little bit, because one of the things in this hangout is we're trying to get more technical, more of the astronautical aspect of these missions. And my question is, with infrared astronomy in particular, it's been made possible in large part by things like Mercad telluride detectors that they're better, I think, in near infrared wavelength, something on the 1 to 5 micron range. What detectors are you needing? And what are the technologies that are being looked at in this wavelength range?
So at the very shortest wavelengths, the Mercad detectors are a possibility. At the long wavelengths, where two of our principal instruments operate, two out of the four instruments on OST, use far infrared detectors. And the two types of detectors I was referring to that are both in the running, one is transition edge sensor bolometers. A bolometer is basically a thermometer, but these are extraordinarily sensitive thermometers. And then an M-KID, which is the M usually stands for microwave, but it's a shorter wavelength application of a kinetic inductance detector. That's the KID part, so M-KIDs. So both of these things have pros and cons. And both have the potential to provide the extraordinary sensitivity that we need.
Okay, and so I've got the diagram or the concept back up again, and we're looking at these two shields or protector ranges. These are based similarly to JWST. The shape is obviously different, but there's two main coolant layers here. Is that right?
To get it to 4K? Well, it's more than two. So the two that you're pointing to on the far left there are nothing more than sun shades.
Oh, I see.
Each one, you know, behind the other gets a little cooler progressively. But then the tubular structure itself has a couple of additional layers. There's what we call a barrel and then a baffle. And at each different stage, you get progressively cooler. And you design the observatory so that you maximally take advantage of cryocooler technology. And a cryocooler has certain temperature stages that it's happiest working at. One of them, just for example, is 70 Kelvin.
Okay.
There's another one, you know, at some cooler temperature, and then finally you get down to the 4 Kelvin that you really want. And the people, of course, are concerned, well, how do you make such a big thing cold? Is this really hard? The answer to this is really that it's just thermodynamics. It's physics. It's very well understood physics. So you can you make a design that looks the way you see it here in this picture, and you ask about how much radiation from the sun, which is a principal warming element, how much reaches each layer, and how much conduction, thermal conduction, can happen from warm parts to cool parts. So you understand all the heating parts, and you do a thermal balance. So you understand that if you want such and such a layer to reach such and such a temperature, let's say 70 degrees Kelvin, then you have to be able to remove a certain amount of heat. And eventually you have a 4 degree Kelvin layer, and you need a certain amount of heat to be removed from that layer to keep its equilibrium temperature 4 degrees Kelvin. And so it's just thermal design, basically, and thermodynamics that tells you how much heat you have to remove. And then you can look at the cryocooler technology, and you know that the cryocooler technology is capable of removing a certain amount of heat at each of its various different temperature stages.
Okay, Larry Keyes is asking, what's the diameter of the telescope? And I'm looking at the third bullet point here. Telescope has a 25 square meter collecting area, the same as JWST. Is that right? The same?
It is right. It's a 5.9 meter diameter telescope, and it has a central hole that's 0.9 meters in diameter. So this is what we call a three mirror anastigmat optical configuration. So you can see a little secondary mirror that's hanging out in front of the primary mirror, and the light bounces off the main 5.9 meter diameter mirror, reflects off of that secondary mirror, and then bounces through the central hole in the primary mirror.
And this is designed for minimal deployment. The JWST was going to be unfolded because it had to be fit in an Ariane 5 rocket. This one has to fit on SLS. And I'm not seeing hexagonal things in there, little segments or anything. This is going to be one optical element?
No, there's going to be segments.
Yeah, go ahead, Margaret.
And it'll be, instead of hexagonal, they're going to be more keystone, which is more what they used with Herschel. And we did it because we wanted to maximize the area within the rocket fairing.
Got it.
And if you do the hexagonal thing, it's less efficient to fit as much air. We wanted to make it as big as JWST was a science limit.
And Larry Keyes is also asking about is it passively cooled due to stability? Is that why you're passively cooling?
Maybe there is passive cooling with the sun shields and stuff. Is it due to stability? I think they have some radiators and things like that.
Okay.
You do it both by shading it and with radiating the light away.
Okay.
So the rest of that, the answer to that question is that it's cooling at different stages, all with the design to get down to 4 degrees Kelvin for the purpose of sensitivity. It's not temperature stability, although it will be very stable, but that's not the driving requirement.
Now, this is a question Peter Quinn asks on a lot of Hangouts, but it's important, and I think it's part of a NASA mandate, I think, for missions going forward. But he goes, can we send missions to maintain it, like the Parker Solar Probe, if tech for that comes around? This is going to go to the L2 point. Are you designing it so that it can be maintained?
Yes.
I think what you mean is serviced.
Well, that's okay. Yeah, serviced.
Yeah.
I'm using his words.
Yeah. In fact, we lucked out because our study manager, Ruth Carter, actually did servicing stuff. And so she's going to write up some concept about how you could go about servicing something like this in a conceptual level.
Yeah. Now, everybody has to do this going forward, right? I mean, everybody, because this is what NASA has talked about.
Okay. Yes.
So
can I just add a couple of words on that?
No. I'm kidding. Nope. Of course.
Oh, all right. Okay. So I'll just say that the actual mandate is to be serviceable, which doesn't necessarily mean that you will take advantage of that in real life, but you may. But even if we now, it would have a great advantage if we can service it, then we can replenish its propellant and extend its lifetime. We can replace instruments and extend its science capability and lifetime. But there is a secondary kind of advantage to designing for serviceability, which is that by doing so, you make the instruments sort of installable in a modular kind of way. And that helps a lot during the integration and test of the whole observatory. So it's a side benefit, but a significant one.
Yeah, all of this kind of begs the question, I guess, what do we mean by serviceability? So part of it is that it has to be modular in design. The components need to be reasonably able to be removed and replaced. What else goes into that definition of serviceable?
That you can grab it. So you have to have like a grappling hook or something like that.
And not necessarily by a person though either, right? These aren't necessarily requiring astronauts to go out and do it, but
that's right.
But yes. Robots could do it as well. We had a hangout
Absolutely.
On that where there's companies looking at this very issue. How can they're making a business model on maintaining and servicing what's up already in space. So that's what I guess we mean by serviceability. And that is good because as Hubble has shown the value of that, I think if anything, even given its difficult beginnings. Okay, James Dugan is asking a question. It's an honest one. We heard with the cost overruns of JWST that the NASA administrator is already hinting that this may affect WFIRST, which is the next big Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, the next big successor to, I guess, James Webb, although it won't be doing the same kinds of things. It's a wide field telescope that has the same resolution as Hubble, but a much, much wider field of view. And it might be affected by this, although for other reasons as well, not necessarily JWST. So the question is JWST budget blowout and other missions over budget affecting this process, not only Origins, but as well as Lynx and HabEx and all the others, and Ulvoir?
I don't know. I possibly, but that's something Science Mission Directorate, we have not been told we need to shift our schedule start date later. We've been given a certain set of parameters, assuming this will go in 2030.
Okay, good. That was the next thing I wanted to get to. When are you expecting this to go out?
That has not been changed. But Dave, do you have any other comments on this?
Well, there are many effects, but certainly the schedule is a possible area of impact. Like you said, we haven't been told about any schedule delay. It's way, way, way too early to know, you know, how that all will ripple through. There's so many factors that come into play. So you really wind up rolling with the punches as these things go. But there, I think it's worth pointing out that there are many other things that we're learning from the JW and other past mission experience that we apply lessons as we design this thing. Certainly, from day one, we designed this knowing that it would have to be a very cold telescope. And so there were things that JWST did in its thermal design that we recognized right off the bat were not the right things to do if you want to make a cold telescope, a very cold telescope like this one.
So that addresses Galaxia's question, why does a different cooling system have to be invented than the one JWST has? That's a lessons learned kind of thing then, right?
It is. Well, they're technical lessons in terms of where you put warm things relative to cold things, I think is the most important aspect of that.
Okay.
We've certainly, I think, convinced ourselves that it's very important to be, not a deployable telescope. Unfortunately, because of the JW delay, the decadal survey won't have the opportunity to know that JW can succeed as it's designed to do.
I know. This is starting to affect a ripple effect, isn't it? It's starting to affect other decadal surveys.
Yeah, that's right. So in any case, if you can have a non-deployable system and accomplish your goals, that's a nice advantage. And so we wanted to make that happen.
I know. We're all going to be really tense during that deployment.
Here's a schedule question for our audience. So that, and when we began, Margaret gave us a brief summary of what the roughly next 12 months is going to be like for this team. When is, according to current plan, when will the decadal survey be completed? and their priorities and selection and advice and so on be known.
Oh, wow. Well, I don't think we've been given that schedule. I think they're working on it. My guess is we'll know in 2020, 2021. They're starting to gear up now, but it's a couple year process. Yeah. So that's why I'm saying possibly a year after would be the earliest. Summer 2020, I think, will be the earliest that we hear about things.
Yeah. Oh. So we hope to have you. We're not wrapping up quite yet. We hope to. Actually, we might be.
Yeah.
We will have you guys back.
Yeah, but hold on. I got one. I want to just ask. I want to end this hangout with a really good question from Astro Malone. This is a good ending question. What plans are made to follow this mission up if you are successful? And what would it mean to you personally if it's a success, if you guys get picked?
Wow.
Would you like to start, Margaret?
I would be extremely thrilled, not just for myself, for the astronomy community, because the discovery space of this mission is enormous. And it'll be very exciting to see what people find with it. I'm going to let Dave handle a follow-up. Like, what would you follow this up with?
Okay, well, I think I understand your pitch there. But before I go in that direction, and thanks for that, the first thing I would say is that at many astronomical gatherings, where rarely, but sometimes I wear a tie, and one of the ties I wear has little children on it in various different professionals. The reason being that I like to point out to people that what we're doing now is not for us. It's really for the next generation. This is certainly not going to happen anytime soon. I'll be really happy if I'm still alive when it happens. But it's really for the next generation of astronomers. And then to pick up where Margaret left off, and really to kind of get to the technical part of, you know, how would you follow up with a telescope like this? One way that you could do that is with an interferometer. And one thing that that OST will be lacking is a high angular resolution, a sort of crisp picture, the fine details of things if you make an image of something. So those protoplanetary disks, for example, or very distant galaxies, those will look like little specks of light to us. So we're very interested in the spectrum that comes from those objects. But it would be very interesting to map out, you know, a spectrum here and a spectrum there, all within the same object, to learn how the materials distributed in a galaxy or a protoplanetary system. That will get us to the next level of detail, and we can certainly do amazing things with an interferometer.
Not you're, but you're not
from multiple telescopes.
But it wouldn't be something like LISA, right? It would be something optical.
That's
correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, that's right. Okay. It would be optical interferometry working at far infrared wavelengths, though.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's all possible.
All right. Well, Harley, I think we've got another hangout behind us now. I want to thank our guest, Margaret Meixner, for the Space Telescope Science Institute. She's on sabbatical at Goddard right now. And thank you. And also David Lesowitz from also from Goddard. Both of these guys are working on the Origin Space Telescope as part of the plan for NASA to follow up on future decadal surveys. We've got JWST, then WFIRST, and then whatever these guys choose for the next one. And one of the runners-up is this one. This was an exciting mission. I hope you guys have learned a little bit more about it. I kind of wish that NASA and the National Academy of Sciences would let the public vote on it, but then I guess that would be sort of maybe counterproductive. I don't know. But it would be fun to see to be able to participate in some of the selection process here. But these guys have done their homework on some really great stuff. I hope you guys have learned some stuff from it. I want to thank all of you for watching it, and I want to thank my gravitational wave rubber duckies.
Guys. Rubber duckies.
Yeah, mine's our Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So
mine's just an average.
Yeah, see, mine can arrest yours, Harley, for riding the gravitational waves too long. That's
the United States. That's an R. That's
magic. Okay, folks. All right. Well, thank you all so much for watching. And as always, next week, I've got a hangout with I think we are going to do a telescope talk finally. I've also got a ground-based hangout. I'm going to do a one-off with Christian Reddy on Tuesday. Watch for that. Also on next week is the Astro Coffee Hangout, and Carol Christian and I will be back talking about the latest discoveries in astronomy from a paper that she will select, and I think I'll learn more about that hopefully early next week. So I will see you guys then. Next time, Harley, we are going to be, are we doing another mission next time, or are we doing the Gateway?
I do not know.
Okay.
We're still waiting. I should, but I don't have it in hand.
Well, we have confirmations and things that we're waiting on. So thanks, Margaret. Thanks, David. I hope you guys will come back when we learn more about what's going on.
Absolutely.
Summer next year, right?
Happy to.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Here we go. Good luck, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Thank you guys for watching. And as always, keep looking up.